It's on the fourth floor. Thanks. I started away, then turned back. Is Dr. Hadlock part of the surgical team?
I don't think so, she said, but he's observing.
I thanked her again and went in search of Wireman. I found him in a far corner of the caff, sitting in front of a paper cup about the size of a World War II mortar shell. Except for a scattering of nurses and orderlies, and one tense-looking family group in another corner of the room, we had the place to ourselves. Most of the chairs were upended on the tables, and a tired-looking lady in red rayon was working out with a mop. An iPod hung in a sling between her breasts. "Hola, mi vato," Wireman said, and gave me a wan smile. His hair neatly combed back when he made his entrance with Elizabeth and Jack had fallen down around his ears, and there were dark circles around his eyes. "Why don't you grab yourself a cup of coffee? It tastes like factory-made shit, but it do prop up a person's eyelids." "No, thanks. Just let me borrow a sip of yours." I had three aspirin in my pants pocket. I fished them out and swallowed them with some of Wireman's coffee. He wrinkled his nose. "In with all your germy change? That's nasty." "I have a strong immune system." "How is she?"
"Not good."
He looked at me bleakly. "Did she come around at all in the ambulance? Say anything else?"
"She did."
"What?" From the pocket of his linen shirt, Wireman took an invitation to my show, with "The View from Duma" printed on one side. On the other, he'd scrawled three notes. They jagged up and down, from the motion of the ambulance, I assumed. But I could read them. "The table is leaking. You will want to, but you mustn't. Drown her back to sleep." They were all spooky, but that last one made the flesh on my arms prickle. "Nothing else?" I asked, handing the invitation back. "She said my name a couple of times. She knew me. And she said yours, Edgar." "Have a look at this," I said, and slid the manila envelope across the table. He asked where I'd gotten it, and I told him. He said it all seemed a little convenient, and I shrugged. I was remembering something Elizabeth had said to me. "The water runs faster now. Soon come the rapids." Well, the rapids were here. I had a feeling this was only the start of the white water. My hip was starting to feel a little better. Its late-night sobbing down to mere sniffles. According to popular wisdom, a dog is man's best friend, but I would vote for aspirin. I pulled my chair around the table and sat next to Wireman, where I could read the headline, "Duma Key Tot Blossoms Following Spill. Is She a Child Prodigy?" Beneath was a photograph. In it was a man I knew well, in a bathing suit I knew well. John Eastlake in his slimmer, trimmer incarnation. He was smiling and holding up a smiling little girl. It was Elizabeth, looking the same age as in the family portrait of Daddy and his girls. Only now she was holding out a drawing to the camera in both hands and wearing a gauze bandage wrapped around her head. There was another, much older girl in the picture, Big Sister Adriana, and yes, she could have been a carrot top. But to begin with, Wireman and I paid little attention to her, or to John Eastlake, or even to the toddler with the bandage around her head. "Holy wow," Wireman said. The picture was of a horse looking over a fence rail. It wore an unlikely and unequine smile. In the foreground, back too, was a little girl with lots of golden ringlets, holding out a carrot the size of a shotgun for the smiling horse to eat. To either side, bracketing the picture almost like theater curtains, were palm trees. Above were puffy white clouds and a great big sun, shooting off happy rays of light. It was a child's picture, but the talent that had created it was beyond doubt. The horse had a joie de vivre that made the smile the punchline of a cheerful joke. You could put a dozen art students in a room, tell them to execute a happy horse, and I was willing to bet not one of them would be able to match the success of that picture. Even the oversized carrot felt not like a mistake, but part of the giggle, an intensifier, an artistic steroid. "It's not a joke," I muttered, bending closer. Only bending closer did no good.
I was seeing this picture through four aggravating levels of obfuscation. The photograph, the newspaper reproduction of the photograph, the Xerox of the newspaper reproduction of the photograph, and time itself. Over 80 years of it, if I had the math right. "What's not a joke?" Wireman asked. "The way the size of the horse is exaggerated, and the carrot, even the sun rays. It's a child's cry of glee, Wireman. A hoax is what it is, got to be. She would have been two. A child of two can't even make stick figures and call them Mommy and Daddy, can she? Was what happened to Candy Brown a hoax? Or what about the bullet that used to be in your brain? The one that's now gone?" He was silent. I tapped child prodigy. Look, they even had the right fancy term for it. Do you suppose if she'd been poor and black, they would have called her Pickaninny Freak and stuck her in a sideshow somewhere? Because I sort of do. If she'd been poor and black, she never would have made the paper at all. Or fallen out of a pony trap to begin with. Is that what happened? I stopped, my eye caught by the blurry photograph again. Now it was Big Sis I was looking at, Adriana. "What?" Wireman asked, and his tone was, "What now?" "Her bathing suit. Look familiar to you?" "I can't see very much, just the top. Elizabeth's holding her picture out in front of the rest. What about the part you can't see?" He looked for a long time. "Wish I had a magnifying glass. That would probably make it worse instead of better." "All right, muchacho, it does look vaguely familiar, but maybe that's just an idea you put in my head." In all the girl and ship paintings, there was only one rowboat girl I was never sure of, the one in number 6, the one with the orangey hair, the one in the blue singlet with the yellow stripe around the neck. I tapped Adriana's blurred image in the photocopy Mary Iyer had given me. "This is the girl. This is the swimming suit. I'm sure of it." So was Elizabeth. "What are we saying here?" Wireman asked. He was skimming the print, rubbing at his temples as he did so. I asked if his eye was bothering him. "No, this is just so fucking..." He looked up at me, eyes big, still rubbing his temples. "She fell out of that goddamn pony trap and hit her head on a rock, or so it says here. Woke up in the doctor's infirmary just as they were getting ready to transport her to the hospital in St. Pete. Seizures thereafter. It says the seizures continue for baby Elizabeth, although they are moderating and seem to do her no lasting harm. And she started painting pictures." I said, "The accident must have happened right after the big group portrait was taken, because she looks exactly the same, and they change fast at that age." Wireman seemed not to notice. "We're all in the same rowboat," he said. I started to ask him what he meant, then realized I didn't have to. "Si, senor," I said. "She fell on her head. I shot myself in the head. You got your head crushed by a payloader." "Crane." He waved his hand as if to indicate this made no difference. Then he used the hand to grip my surviving wrist. His fingers were cold. "I have questions, muchacho. How come she stopped painting? And how come I never started?" "I can't say for certain why she stopped. Maybe she forgot, blocked it out, or maybe she deliberately lied and denied. As for you, your talent's empathy. And on Duma Key, empathy got raised to telepathy." "That's bullshit." He trailed off. I waited. "No," he said. "No, it's not. But it's also completely gone. You want to know something, amigo?" "Sure." He cocked a thumb at the tense family group across the room from us. They had gone back to their discussion. Pop was now shaking his finger at Mom, or maybe it was Sis. "A couple months ago, I could have told you what that hoop to do was about. Now all I could do is make an educated guess." "And probably come out in much the same place," I said. "Would you trade one for the other in any case? Your eyesight for the occasional thought wave?" "God, no," he said, then looked around the calf with an ironic, despairing, head-cocked smile. "I can't believe we're having this discussion, you know. I keep thinking I'll wake up and it'll all be as you were, Private Wireman. Assume the position." I looked him in the eye. Ain't gonna happen.
10. According to the Weekly Echo, Baby Elizabeth, as she was referred to almost throughout, began her artistic endeavors on the very first day of her at-home convalescence. She quickly went on, gaining skill and prowess with each passing hour, it seemed to her amazed father. She started with colored pencils. "Sound familiar?" Wireman asked. Before progressing to a box of watercolors the bemused John Eastlake brought home from Venice. In the 3 months following her accident, much of it spent in bed, she had done literally hundreds of watercolors, turning them out at a rate John Eastlake and the other girls found a little frightening. If Nan Melda had an opinion, it wasn't offered in print. Eastlake tried to slow her down on doctor's orders, but this was counterproductive. It caused fretfulness, crying fits, insomnia, bouts of fever. Baby Elizabeth said when she couldn't draw or paint, her head hurted. Her father said that when she did paint, she ate like one of the horses she liked to draw. The article's author, one M. Rickert, seemed to find this endearing. Recalling my own eating binges, I found it all too familiar. I was going over the muddy print for the third time, with Wireman where my right arm would have been, if I'd had a right arm, when the door opened and Gene Hadlock came in. He was still wearing the black tie and bright pink shirt he'd had on at the show, although the tie had been pulled down and the collar was loosened. He was still wearing green scrub pants and green booties over his shoes. His head was down. When he looked up, I saw a face that was as long and sad as an old bloodhound's. 11:19, he said. There was never really a chance. Wireman put his face in his hands. 11. I got to the Ritz at 12:45 in the morning, limping with fatigue and not wanting to be there. I wanted to be in my bedroom at Big Pink. I wanted to lie in the middle of my bed, push the strange new doll to the floor as I had the ornamental pillows, and hug Reba to me. I wanted to lie there and look at the turning fan. Most of all, I wanted to listen to the whispered conversation of the shells under the house as I drifted off to sleep. Instead, I had this lobby to deal with, too ornate, too full of people and music, cocktail piano, even at this hour. Most of all, too bright. Still, my family was here. I had missed the celebratory dinner. I would not miss the celebratory breakfast. I asked the clerk for my key. He gave it to me, along with a stack of messages. I opened them one after another. Most were congratulations. The one from Ilsa was different. It read, "Are you okay? If I don't see you by 8 a.m., I'm coming to find you. Fair warning." At the very bottom was one from Pam. The note itself was only 4 words long. "I know she died." Everything else that needed saying was expressed by the enclosure. It was her room key. 12. I stood outside 8:47 5 minutes later with the key in my hand. I'd moved it toward the slot, then moved my finger toward the doorbell, then looked back toward the elevators. I must have stood that way for 5 minutes or more, too exhausted to make up my mind, and might have stood there even longer if I hadn't heard the elevator doors open, followed by the sound of tipsy, convivial laughter. I was afraid it would turn out to be someone I knew, Tom and Bosie, or Big Ange and his wife, maybe even Lynn and Rick. In the end, I hadn't booked the entire floor, but I'd taken most of it. I pushed the key into the lock. It was the electronic kind you didn't even have to turn. A green light came on, and as the laughter from down the hall came closer, I slipped inside. I had ordered her a suite, and the living room was big. There had apparently been a before-show party because there were 2 room service tables and lots of plates with remains of canapés on them. I spotted 3 champagne buckets. 2 of the bottles were sticking bottoms up, dead soldiers. The third appeared to still be alive, although on life support. That made me think of Elizabeth again. I saw her sitting beside her China village, looking like Katharine Hepburn in Woman of the Year, saying, "See how I put the children outside the schoolhouse. Do come see." Pain is the biggest power of love. That's what Wireman says.
I threaded my way around chairs where my nearest and dearest had sat, talking and laughing, and, I was sure of it, toasting my hard work and good fortune. I took the last champagne bottle from the pool in which it sat, held it up to the wall-length picture window showcasing Sarasota Bay, and said, "Here's to you, Elizabeth. Hasta la vista, mi amada." What does amada mean? I turned. Pam was standing in the bedroom doorway. She was wearing a blue nightgown, I didn't remember. Her hair was down. It hadn't been so long since Ilsa was in junior high school. It touched her shoulders. "It means darling," I said. "I learned it from Wireman. He was married to a Mexican woman."
"Was?"
"She died."
"Who told you about Elizabeth?"
"The young man who works for you. I asked him to call if there was news. I'm so sorry." I smiled. I tried to put the champagne bottle back and missed the bucket. Hell, I missed the table. The bottle hit the carpet and rolled. Once the daughter of the godfather had been a child, holding out her picture of a smiling horse for a photographer's camera. The photographer probably some jazzy guy wearing a straw hat and arm garters. Then she'd been an old woman jittering away the last of her life in a wheelchair while her snood came loose and flailed from one final hairpin under the fluorescent lights of an art gallery office. And the time between? It probably seemed like no more than a nod or the wave of a hand to the clear blue sky. In the end, we all go smash to the floor. Pam held out her arms. There was a full moon shining in through the big window, and by its light I could see the rose tattoo on the swell of her breast. Something else new and different. But the breast was familiar. I knew it well. "Come here," she said. I came. I struck one of the room service tables with my bad hip, gave a muttering cry, and stumbled the last two steps into her arms, thinking this was a nice reunion. We were both going to land on the carpet, me on top of her. Maybe I could even break a couple of her ribs. It was certainly possible. I'd put on 20 pounds since coming to Duma Key. But she was strong. I forgot that. She held my weight, at first bracing against the side of the bedroom door, then standing up straight with me in her arms. I put my own arm around her and laid my cheek on her shoulder, just breathing in the scent of her. Wireman. I woke up early, and I've been having such a wonderful time with my chinas. Come on, Eddie, you're tired. Come to bed. She led me into the bedroom. The window in here was smaller, the moonlight thinner. But the window was open, and I could hear the constant sigh of the water.
Are you sure?
Hush. I'm sure I've been told your name, but it escapes me. So much does now. I never meant to hurt you. I'm so sorry. She put two fingers against my lips. I don't want you sorry. We sat side by side on the bed in the shadows.
What do you want?
She showed me with a kiss. Her breath was warm and tasted of champagne. For a little while I forgot about Elizabeth and Wireman, picnic baskets, and Duma Key. For a little while there was just she and I, like the old days, the two-arm days. For a little while after that, I slept, until the first light came creeping. The loss of memory isn't always the problem. Sometimes, maybe even often, it's the solution. How to draw a picture. 8. Be brave. Don't be afraid to draw the secret things. No one said art was always a zephyr. Sometimes it's a hurricane. And then you must not hesitate or change course, because if you tell yourself the great lie of bad art, that you are in charge, your chance at the truth will be lost. The truth isn't always pretty. Sometimes the truth is the big boy. The little ones say, it's Libet's frog, a frog with teeth. And sometimes it's something even worse, something like Charlie in his bright blue breeches. Or her. Here is a picture of little Libet with her finger to her lips. She says, shh. She says, if you'll talk, she'll hear. So shh. She says, bad things can happen, and upside-down talking birds are just the first and least, so shh. If you try to run, something awful may come out of the cypress and gumbo limbo and catch you on the road. There are even worse things in the water down at Shade Beach, worse than the big boy, worse than Charlie, who moves so quick. They're in the water, waiting to drown you. And not even drowning is the end, no. Not even drowning, so shh. But for the true artist, the truth will insist. Libet Eastlake can hush her mouth, but not her paints and pencils. There's only one person she dares talk to, and only one place she can do it. Only one place at Heron's Roost where her hold seems to fail. She makes Nan Mel to go there with her, and tries to explain how this happened, how the talent demanded the truth and the truth slithered out of her grasp. She tries to explain how the drawings have taken over her life, and how she has come to hate the little China doll Daddy found with the rest of the treasure, the little China woman who was Libet's fair salvage. She tries to explain her deepest fear. If they don't do something, the twins may not be the only ones to die, only the first ones, and the deaths may not end on Duma Key. She gathers all her courage, and for a child who is little more than a baby, she must have had a great lot of it, and tells the whole truth, mad as it is. First about how she made the hurricane, but that it wasn't her idea, it was her idea. I think Nan Melda believes it. Because she's seen the big boy? Because she's seen Charlie? I think she saw both. The truth has to come out, that's the basis of art. But that's not to say the world must see it. Nan Melda says, "Wear your new doll now, the China doll." Libet says, "In my special treasure box, my heart box." Nan Melda says, "And what her name?" Libet says, "Her name is Percy." Nan Melda says, "Percy, a boy's name." And Libet says, "I can't help it, her name is Percy, that's the truth." And she says, "Percy has a ship. It looks nice, but it's not nice. It's bad. What are we going to do, Nanny?" Nan Melda thinks about it as they stand there in the one safe place. And I believe she knew what needed to be done. She might not have been an art critic, no Mary Eyre, but I think she knew. The bravery is in the doing, not in the showing. The truth can be hidden away again if it's too terrible for the world to look at. And it happens. I'm sure it happens all the time. I think every artist worth a damn has a red picnic basket. XIV. The Red Basket. 1. "Share your pool, mister?" It was Ilsa, in green shorts and matching halter. Her feet were bare, her face without makeup and puffy with sleep. Her hair was yanked back in a ponytail, the way she'd worn it when she was 11, and if not for the fullness of her breasts, she could have passed for that 11-year-old. "Any time," I said. She sat beside me on the tiled lip of the pool. We were about halfway down, my butt on 5 and hers on FT. "You're up early," I said, but this didn't surprise me. Illy had always been our restless one. "I was worried about you. Especially when Mr. Wireman called Jack to say that nice old woman died. It was Jack who told us. We were still at dinner." "I know. I'm so sorry." She put her head on my shoulder. "And on your special night, too." I put my arm around her. "Anyway, I only slept a couple of hours, and then I got up because it was light. And when I looked out, who should I see sitting beside the pool but my father all by himself? Couldn't sleep anymore. I just hope I didn't wake your—" I stopped, aware of Ilsa's large, round eyes. "Don't go getting any ideas, Miss Cookie. It was strictly comfort." It had not been strictly comfort, but what it had been was something I wasn't prepared to explore with my daughter. Or myself, for that matter. She slumped a little, then straightened and looked at me, head tilted, the beginnings of a smile at the corners of her mouth. "If you have hopes, that's your business," I said. "But I would advise you not to get them up. I'm always going to care for her, but sometimes people go too far to turn back. I'm pretty sure that's the case with us." She looked back at the still surface of the pool, the little smile at the corners of her mouth dying away. I hated to see it go, but maybe it was for the best. All right, then. That left me free to move on to other matters. I didn't want to, but I was still her father, and she was, in many ways, still a child. Which meant that no matter how badly I felt about Elizabeth Eastlake this morning, or how confused I might be about my own situation, I still had certain duties to fulfill. Need to ask you something, Illy.
Okay, sure.
Are you not wearing the ring because you don't want your mother to see it and go nuclear, which I would fully understand, or because you and Carson...
I sent it back,
she said in a flat and toneless voice. Then she giggled, and a stone rolled off my heart. But I sent it UPS, and I insured it.
So, it's over?
Well, never say never. Her feet were in the water, and she kicked them slowly back and forth. Carson doesn't want it to be, so he says. I'm not sure I do either. At least not without seeing how we do face to face. The phone or email really isn't the way to talk something like this out. Plus, I want to see if the attraction is still there, and if so, how much? She glanced sideways, a little anxiously. That doesn't gross you out, does it?
No, honey.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
How many second chances did you give Mom?
I smiled.
Over the course of the marriage, I'd say 200 or so.
And how many did she give you?
About the same.
Did you ever...
She stopped. I can't ask you that. I looked at the pool, aware of a very middle-class flush rising in my cheeks. Since we're having this discussion at 6 in the morning and not even the pool boy's here yet, and since I think I know what your problem with Carson Jones is, you can ask. The answer is no, not even once. But if I'm dead honest, I have to say that it was more luck than stone-ass righteousness. There were times when I came close, and once when it was probably only luck or fate or providence that kept it from happening. I don't think the marriage would have ended if the accident had happened. I think there are worse offenses against a partner, but they don't call it cheating for nothing. One slip can be excused as human fallibility. Two can be excused as human frailty. After that, I shrugged.
He says it was just once.
Her voice was little more than a whisper. Her feet had slowed to a dreamy underwater drift. He said she started coming on to him and finally, you know.
Sure. It happens that way all the time, in books and movies anyway. Maybe sometimes in real life, too.
Just because it sounded like a self-serving lie didn't mean it was.
The girl he sings with?
Ilsa nodded.
Bridget Andreasen.
She of the bad breath.
Faint smile.
I seem to remember you telling me not too long ago that he'd have to make a choice.
A long silence, then.
It's complicated.
It always is. Ask any drunk in a bar who's been thrown out by his wife.
I kept quiet.
He told her he doesn't want to see her anymore, and the duets are off. I know that for a fact because I checked some of the latest reviews on the internet.
She colored faintly at this, although I didn't blame her for checking. I would have checked, too.
When Mr. Fredericks, he's the tour director, threatened to send him home, Carson told him he could if he wanted to, but he wasn't singing with that holy blonde bitch anymore.
Were those his exact words?
She smiled brilliantly.
He's a Baptist, Daddy. I'm interpreting. Anyway, Carson stood his ground and Mr. Fredericks relented. For me, that's a mark in his favor.
Yes, I thought. But still, he's a cheater who calls himself Smiley.
I took her hand.
What's your next move?
She sighed. The ponytail made her look 11. The sigh made her sound 40.
I don't know. I'm at a loss.
Then let me help you. Will you do that?
All right.
For the time being, stay away from him, I said, and discovered I wanted that with all my heart. But there was more. When I thought of the girl in ship paintings, especially the girl in the rowboat, I wanted to tell her not to talk to strangers. keep her hairdryer away from the bathtub, and jog only at the college track, never across Roger Williams Park at dusk. She was looking at me quizzically, and I managed to get myself in gear again. Go right back to school. I wanted to talk to you about that. I nodded but squeezed her arm to show her I wasn't quite finished. Finish your semester, make your grades, let Carson finish the tour. Get perspective, then get together. Understand what I'm saying? Yes. She understood but didn't sound convinced. When you do get together, do it on neutral ground. And I don't mean to embarrass you, but it's still just the two of us, so I'm going to say this. Bed is not neutral ground. She looked down at her swimming feet. I reached out and turned her face to mine. When the issues aren't resolved, bed is a battleground. I wouldn't even have dinner with the guy until you know where you stand with him. Meet in, I don't know, Boston. Sit on a park bench and work it out. Get it clear in your mind and make sure it's clear in his. Then have dinner, do a Red Sox game, or go to bed if you think it's the right thing. Just because I don't want to think about your sex life doesn't mean I don't think you should have one. She relieved me considerably by laughing. At the sound, a waiter who still looked half asleep came out to ask us if we wanted coffee. We said we did. When he went to get it, Ilsa said, "All right, Daddy, point taken. I was going to tell you that I'm going back this afternoon anyway. I have an anthro prelim at the end of the week, and there are a bunch of us who've formed a little study group. We call ourselves the Survivors Club." She regarded me anxiously. "Would that be okay? I know you were planning on a couple of days, but now there's this thing with your friend." "No, honey, that's fine." I kissed the tip of her nose, thinking that if I was close up, she wouldn't see how pleased I was. Pleased that she'd come for the show, pleased that we'd had some time together this morning, pleased most of all that she would be 1,000 miles north of Duma Key by the time the sun went down tonight. Assuming she could get a flight reservation, that was. "And as for Carson?" She sat quiet for perhaps an entire minute, swinging her bare feet back and forth through the water. Then she stood up and took my arm, helping me to my feet. "I think you're right. I'll say that if he's serious about our relationship, he'll just have to put everything on hold until July 4th. Now that her decision was made, her eyes were bright again. "That'll get me to the end of the semester and a month of summer vacation besides. It'll get him through to his last show at the Cow Palace, plus plenty of time to figure out if he's as finished with Blondie as he thinks he is. Does it suit you, Father dear?" "Down to the ground." "Here comes the coffee," she said. "Now the question is, how long until breakfast?"
2. Wireman wasn't at the morning after breakfast, but he had reserved the Bay Island room from 8 to 10. I presided over 2 dozen friends and family members, most from Minnesota. It was one of those events people remember and talk about for decades, partly because of encountering so many familiar faces in an exotic setting, partly because the emotional atmosphere was so volatile. On the one hand, there was the very palpable sense of hometown boy makes good. They had sensed it at the show, and their judgment was confirmed in the morning papers. The reviews in the Sarasota Herald Tribune and the Venice Gondolier were great, but short. Mary Iyer's piece in the Tampa Trib, on the other hand, took up nearly a whole page and was lyrical. She must have written most of it ahead of time. She called me a major new American talent. My mother, always a bit of a sourpuss, would have said, "Take that and a dime and you can wipe your ass in comfort." Of course, that was her saying 40 years ago when a dime bought more than it does today. Elizabeth, of course, was the other hand. There was no death notice for her, but a boxed item had been added to the page of the Tampa paper carrying Mary's review. Well-known art patron stricken at Fremantle show. The story, just 2 paragraphs long, stated that Elizabeth Eastlake, a longtime fixture on the Sarasota art scene and resident of Duma Key, had suffered an apparent seizure not long after arriving at the Scotto Gallery and had been taken by ambulance to Sarasota Memorial Hospital. No word of her condition was available at press time. My Minnesota people knew that on the night of my triumph, a good friend had died. There would be bursts of laughter and occasional raillery, then glances in my direction to see if I minded. By 9:30, the scrambled eggs I'd eaten were sitting like lead in my stomach.
and I was getting one of my headaches, the first in almost a month. I excused myself to go upstairs. I'd left a small bag in the room I hadn't slept in. The shaving kit contained several foil packets of Zomig, a migraine medication. It wouldn't stop a full-blown Force 5, but it usually worked if I took a dose early enough. I swallowed one with a Coke from the bar fridge, started to leave, and saw the light on the phone flashing. I almost left it, then realized the message might be from Wireman. It turned out there were a half dozen messages. The first four were more congratulations, which fell on my aching head like pellets of hail on a tin roof. By the time I got to Jimmy's, he was the fourth, I had begun punching the 6 button on the keypad, which hurried me on to the next message. I was in no mood to be stroked. The fifth message was indeed from Jerome Wireman. He sounded tired and stunned. "Edgar, I know you've got a couple days earmarked for family and friends, and I hate like hell to ask you this, but can we get together at your place this afternoon? We need to talk, and I mean really. Jack spent the night here with me at El Palacio. He didn't want me to be alone. That's one hell of a good kid. And we were up early hunting for that red basket she was on about, and, well, we found it. Better late than never, right? She wanted you to have it, so Jack took it over to Big Pink. The house was unlocked, and listen, Edgar, someone's been inside." Silence on the line, but I could hear him breathing then. "Jack's severely freaked, and you gotta prepare for a shock, muchacho. Though you may already have an idea." There was a beep, and then the sixth message started. It was still Wireman, now rather pissed off, which made him sound more like himself. "Fucking short-ass message tape, chinche pedora, ay. Edgar, Jack and I are going over to Abbott Wexler, they're..." A brief pause as he worked to keep it together. "The funeral home she wanted. I'll be back by 1. You really ought to wait for us before you go in your house. It isn't trashed or anything, but I want to be with you when you look in that basket and when you see what got left in your studio upstairs. I don't like to be mysterious, but Wireman ain't putting this shit on a message tape anybody might listen to. And there's one more thing. One of her lawyers called, left a message on the machine. Jack and I were still up in the fucking attic. He says I'm her sole beneficiary." A pause. "La Loteria." A pause. "I get everything." A pause. "Fuck me." That was all. 3. I punched 0 for the hotel operator. After a short wait, she gave me the number of the Abbott Wexler funeral parlor. I dialed it. A robot answered, offering me a truly amazing array of death-oriented services. "For casket showroom, push 5. I waited it out. The offer for an actual human being always comes last these days, a booby prize for boobs who can't cope with the 21st century. And while I waited, I thought about Wireman's message. The house unlocked? Really? My post-accident memory was unreliable, of course, but habit wasn't. Big Pink did not belong to me, and I had been taught since earliest childhood to take special care of what belonged to others. I was pretty sure I had locked the house. So if someone had been inside, why hadn't the door been forced? I thought for just a moment of the 2 little girls in wet dresses, little girls with decayed faces who spoke in the grating voice of the shells under the house, and then pushed the image away with a shudder. They had been only imagination, surely, the vision of an overstrained mind. And even if they had been something more, ghosts didn't have to unlock doors, did they? They simply passed right through or drifted up through the floorboards. 0 if you need help. By God, I had almost missed my cue. I pushed 0, and after a few bars of something that sounded vaguely like "Abide with me," a professionally soothing voice asked if it could help me. I suppressed an irrational and very strong urge to say, "It's my arm! It's never had a decent burial!" and hang up. Instead, cradling the phone and rubbing a spot over my right eyebrow, I asked if Jerome Wireman was there. "May I ask which deceased he represents?" A nightmare image rose before me, a silent courtroom of the dead, and Wireman saying, "Your Honor, I object." "Elizabeth Eastlake," I said. Ah, of course. The voice warmed, became provisionally human. He and his young friend have stepped out. They were going to work on Miss Eastlake's obituary, I believe. I may have a message for you. Will you hold? I held. Abide with me resumed. Digger the undertaker eventually returned. Mr. Wireman asks if you would join him and, Mr. Candori, if possible, at your place on Duma Key at 2 this afternoon. It says, if you arrive first, please wait outside. Have you got that? I do. You don't know if he'll be back? No, he didn't say. I thanked him and hung up. If Wireman had a cell phone, I'd never seen him carrying it. And I didn't have the number in any case. But Jack had one. I dug the number out of my wallet and dialed it. It diverted to voicemail on the first ring, which told me it was either turned off or dead, either because Jack had forgotten to charge it or because he hadn't paid the bill. Either one was possible. Jack's severely freaked, and you've got to prepare for a shock. I want to be with you when you look in that basket. But I already had a pretty good idea about what was in the basket, and I doubted if Wireman had been surprised either. Not really. 4. The Minnesota Mafia was silent around the long table in the Bay Island room. And even before Pam stood up, I realized they had been doing more than talking about me while I was gone. They had been holding a meeting. We're going back, Pam said. That is, most of us are. The Slobotniks had plans to visit Disney World when they came down, and the Jamesons are going on to Miami. And we're going with them, Daddy, Melinda said. She was holding Rick's arm. We can get a flight back to Orly from there that's actually cheaper than the one you booked. I think we could stand the expense, I said, but I smiled. I felt the strangest mixture of relief, disappointment, and fear. At the same time, I could feel the bands that had been tightening in my head come unlocked and start dropping away. The incipient headache was gone, just like that. It could have been the Zomig, but the stuff usually doesn't work that fast, even with a caffeine-laced drink to give it a boost.
Have you heard from your friend Wireman this morning? Kamen rumbled. Yes, I said. He left a message on my machine. And how was he doing?
Well, that was a long story, wasn't it? He's coping, doing the funeral parlor thing, and Jack's helping, but he's rocky. Go help him, Tom Riley said. That's your job for the day.
Yes, indeed, Bosie added. You're grieving yourself, Edgar. You don't need to be playing host right now.
I called the airport, Pam said, as if I had protested, which I hadn't. The Gulfstream's standing by, and the concierge is helping to make the other travel arrangements. In the meantime, we've still got this morning. Question is, what do we do with it? We ended up doing what I had planned. We visited the John and Mabel Ringling Museum of Art. And I wore my beret.
5. Early that afternoon, I found myself standing in the boarding area at Dolphin Aviation, kissing my friends and relatives goodbye, or shaking their hands, or hugging them, or all three. Melinda, Rick, and the Jamesons were already gone. Kathy Green, the rehab queen, kissed me with her usual ferocity.
You take care of yourself, Edgar, she said. I love your paintings, but I'm much more proud of the way you're walking. You've made amazing progress. I'd like to parade you in front of my latest generation of crybabies.
You're tough, Kathy.
Not so tough, she said, wiping her eyes. Truth is, I'm a freaking marshmallow.
Then Kamen was towering over me.
If you need help, get in touch ASAP.
Yep, I said. You be the Kamen doc. Kamen smiled. It was like having God smile on you.
I don't think all's right with you yet, Edgar. I can only hope it will be right. No one deserves more to land with the shiny side up and the rubber side down.
I hugged him. A one-armed hug, but he made up for it. I walked out to the plane beside Pam. We stood at the foot of the boarding stairs while the others got on. She was holding my hand in both of hers, looking up at me.
I'm only going to kiss you on the cheek, Edgar. Illy's watching, and I don't want her to get the wrong idea.
She did so, then said, I'm worried about you. There's a white look around your eyes that I don't like. Elizabeth, She shook her head a tiny bit.
It was there last night, even before she came to the gallery. Even when you were at your happiest. A white look. I don't know how to describe it any better than that. I only saw it once before. Back in 1992, when it looked for a little while like you might miss that balloon payment and lose the business. The jet engines were whining and a hot breeze was blowing her hair around her face, tumbling her careful beauty shop curls into something younger and more natural. Can I ask you something, Eddie?
Of course.
Could you paint anywhere, or does it have to be here?
Anywhere, I think, but it would be different somewhere else.
She was looking at me fixedly, almost pleadingly. Just the same, a change might be good. You need to lose that white look. I'm not talking about coming back to Minnesota necessarily, just going somewhere else. Will you think about it?
Yes.
But not until I saw what was in the red picnic basket. And not until I'd made at least one trip to the south end of the Key. And I thought I could do that, because Ilsa was the one who'd gotten sick, not me. All I'd had was one of my red-tinged flashbacks to the accident and that phantom itch. Be well, Edgar. I don't know exactly what's become of you, but there's still enough of the old you to love. She stood on tiptoe in her white sandals, bought specially for this trip, I had no doubt, and planted another soft kiss on my stubbly cheek. Thank you, I said. Thank you for last night. No thanks required, she said. It was sweet. She squeezed my hand, and then she was up the stairs and gone. 6. Outside Delta departures again, this time without Jack.
Just you and me, Miss Cookie, I said. Looks like we closed down the bar.
Then I saw she was crying and wrapped my arm around her.
Daddy, I wish I could stay here with you.
Go back, honey. Study for your test and knock the hell out of it. I'll see you soon. She pulled back, looked at me anxiously.
You'll be okay?
Yes. And you be okay, too.
I will, I will.
I hugged her again. Go on, check in, buy magazines, watch CNN. Fly well.
All right, Daddy. It was amazing.
You're amazing. She gave me a hearty smack on the mouth to make up for the one her mother had held back on, perhaps, and went in through the sliding doors. She turned back once and waved to me, by then little more than a girl's shape behind the polarized glass. I wished with all my heart that I could have seen her better, because I never saw her again. 7. From the Ringling Art Museum, I had left messages for Wireman, one at the funeral home and one on the El Palacio's answering machine, saying I'd be back around 3 and asking him to meet me there. I also asked him to tell Jack that if Jack was old enough to vote and party with FSU sorority girls, he was old enough to take care of his damn cell phone. It was actually close to 3:30 when I arrived back on the Key. But both Jack's car and Elizabeth's vintage silver Benz were parked on the cracked square to the right of Big Pink, and the two of them were sitting on my back stoop drinking iced tea. Jack was still wearing his gray suit, but his hair was once more in its customary disarray, and he was wearing a devil rays tee under his jacket. Wireman was wearing black jeans and a white shirt open at the collar, and Nebraska Cornhusker's gimme cap was cocked back on his head. I parked, got out, and stretched, trying to get my bad hip in gear. They stood up and came to meet me, neither of them smiling.
"Everyone gone, amigo?" Wireman asked.
"Everyone but my Aunt Jean and Uncle Ben," I said. "They're veteran freeloaders, dedicated to squeezing a good thing to the very last drop." Jack smiled without much humor.
"Every family's got a few," he said.
"How are you?" I asked Wireman.
"About Elizabeth, I'm okay. Hadlock said it was probably for the best this way, and I suppose he's right. Her leaving me what may amount to $160 million in cash, securities, and properties..."
He shook his head.
"That's different. Maybe someday I'll have the luxury of trying to get my head around it, but right now something's going on."
"Si, senor, and it's very weird."
How much have you told Jack? Wireman looked a bit uncomfortable. Well, I'll tell you what, amigo. Once I started, it was damn hard to find a reasonable stopping place.
He told me all of it, Jack said, or so he claims, including what he thinks you did about restoring his eyesight and what you think you did to Candy Brown.
He paused. And the two little girls you saw. Are you okay with the Candy Brown thing? I asked.
If it was up to me, I'd give you a medal. And the people of Sarasota would probably give you your own float in the Memorial Day parade.
Jack stuffed his hands in his pockets.
But if you told me last fall that stuff like this could happen outside of M. Night Shyamalan movies, I would have laughed.
What about last week? I asked.
Jack thought about it.
On the other side of Big Pink, the waves came steadily in. Under my living room and bedroom, the shells would be talking.
No, he said, probably wouldn't have laughed then.
I knew from the first there was something about you, Edgar. You got here and... He ran the fingers of his two hands together, lacing them. And I thought that was right. That was how it had been. Like the fingers of two hands lacing together. And the fact that I only had one hand never mattered. Not here.
What are you saying, Hermano?
Wireman asked. Jack shrugged.
Edgar and Duma. Duma and Edgar. It was like they were waiting for each other.
He looked embarrassed, but not unsure. I cocked a thumb at my house. Let's go in.
Tell him about finding the basket first, Wireman said to Jack.
Jack shrugged.
Wasn't no thing. Didn't take 20 minutes. It was sitting up on top of some old bureau at the far end of the attic. Light from one of the vents to the outside was shining on it, like it wanted to be found.
He glanced at Wireman, who nodded agreement.
Anyway, we took it down to the kitchen and looked inside. It was heavier than hell.
Jack talking about the heaviness of the basket made me think of how Melda, the housekeeper, had been holding it in the family portrait, with her arms bunched. Apparently it had been heavy back then, too.
Wireman told me to bring the basket down here and leave it for you since I had a key. Only I didn't need a key. Place was unlocked.
Was the door actually open?
No. What I did first was turn my key and actually locked it again. Gave me a hell of a surprise.
Come on, Wireman said, leading the way.
Show and tell time.
There was a fair amount of Florida Gulf Coast scattered on the hardwood floor of the entry. Sand, small shells, a couple of sephora husks, and a few bits of dried sawgrass. There were also tracks. The sneaker prints were Jack's. It was the others that made my skin freckle with goosebumps. I made out three sets, one large and two small. The small ones were tracks of children. All of those feet had been bare.
Do you see how they go up the stairs, fading as they go? Jack said.
Yes, I said. My voice sounded faint and far away to my own ears.
I walked beside them because I didn't want to mess them up, Jack said. If I'd known then what Wireman told me while we were waiting for you, I don't think I could have gone up at all.
I don't blame you, I said.
But there was no one there, Jack said. Just, well, you'll see. And look.
He led me to the side of the stairs. The ninth riser was on our eye level, and with the light striking across it, I could see very faintly the tracks of small bare feet pointing the other way.
Jack said, "This looks pretty clear to me. The kids went up to your studio, then came back down again. The adults stayed by the front door, probably as lookout. Although if this was the middle of the night, there probably wasn't much to look out for. Have you been setting the burglar alarm?"
"No," I said, not quite meeting his eye. "I can't remember the numbers. I keep them on a slip of paper in my wallet, but each time I came through the door, it turned into a race against time, me versus that fucking beeper on the wall."
"It's okay."
Wireman gripped my shoulder.
"These burglars didn't take. They left."
"You don't really believe Miss Eastlake's dead sisters paid you another visit, do you?" Jack asked.
"Actually," I said, "I think they did."
I thought that would sound stupid in the bright light of an April afternoon with a ton of sunlight pouring down and reflecting off the gulf, but it didn't.
In Scooby-Doo, it would turn out to be the crazy librarian, Jack said. You know, trying to scare you off the key so he could keep the treasure for himself.
If only, I said.
Suppose those small tracks were made by Tessie and Laura Eastlake, Wireman said. Who made the bigger ones?
Neither of us replied. Let's go upstairs, I said at last. I want to look in the basket. We went up, avoiding the tracks, not to preserve them, but simply because no one wanted to step on them, to Little Pink. The picnic basket, looking just like the one I'd drawn with the red pen I'd pilfered from Jean Hadlock's examining room, was sitting on the carpet, but my eyes were drawn first to my easel. You can believe I beat a hasty retreat when I saw that, Jack said. I could believe it, but I felt no urge to retreat. Quite the opposite. I was drawn forward instead, like an iron bolt to a magnet. A fresh canvas had been set up there, and then, sometime in the dead of night, maybe while Elizabeth had been dying, maybe while I'd been having sex with Pam for the last time, maybe while I'd been sleeping beside her, a finger had dipped into my paint. Whose finger? I didn't know. What color? That was obvious. Red. The letters that staggered and draggled and dripped their way across the canvas were red and accusing. They seemed almost to shout, "Where our sister?" 8. Found art, I said in a dry, rattlebox voice that hardly sounded like my own.
Is that what it is? Wireman asked.
Sure. The letters seemed to waver in front of me, and I wiped my eyes. Graffiti art. They'd love it at the Scoto.
Maybe, but that's some creepy shit, Jack said. I hate it.
So did I. And it was my studio, goddammit. Mine. I had a lease. I snatched the canvas off the easel, momentarily expecting it to burn my fingers. It didn't. It was just a canvas, after all, one I'd stretched myself. I put it against the wall, facing in. Is that better?
It is, actually, Jack said, and Wireman nodded.
Edgar, if those little girls were here, can ghosts write on canvas? If they can move Ouija board planchettes and write in window frost, I imagine they could write on a canvas, I said. Then, rather reluctantly, I added, but I don't see ghosts unlocking my front door or putting a canvas up on the easel to begin with.
There wasn't a canvas there? Wireman asked.
I'm pretty sure not. The blank ones are all racked in the corner.
Who's the sister? Jack wanted to know. Who's the sister they're asking about?
Must be Elizabeth, I said.
She was the only sister left.
Bullshit, Wireman said. If Tessie and Laura were on the ever-popular other side of the veil, they wouldn't have any problem locating Sister Elizabeth. She was right here on Duma Key for over 55 years, and Duma was the only place they ever knew.
What about the others, I asked.
Maria and Hannah both died, Wireman said. Hannah in the 70s in New York, Ossining, I think, and Maria in the early 80s, somewhere out west. Both married, Maria a couple times. I know that from Chris Shannington, not Miss Eastlake. She sometimes talked about her father, but hardly ever about her sisters. She cut herself off from the rest of the family after she and John came back to Duma in 1951.
Where our sister?
And Adriana, what about her?
He shrugged.
Quién sabe? History ate her up. Shannington thinks she and her new husband probably went back to Atlanta after the search for the Babians was called off. They weren't here for the memorial service.
She might have blamed Daddy for what happened, Jack said.
Wireman nodded. Or maybe she just couldn't stand to hang around.
I remembered Adriana's pouty, I want to be somewhere else look in the family portrait and thought Wireman might be onto something there.
In any case, Wireman went on, she has to be dead, too. If she was alive, she'd be almost 100. Odds of that are mighty slim.
Where our sister?
Wireman gripped my arm and turned me to face him. His face looked drawn and old.
Muchacho, if something supernatural killed Miss Eastlake in order to shut her up, maybe we ought to take the hint and get off Duma Key.
I think it might be too late for that, I said.
Why? Because she's awake again. Elizabeth said so before she died.
Who's awake?
Percy, I said.
Who is that?
I don't know, I said. But I think we're supposed to drown her back to sleep.